had bees. So I did get some with, and I also did birds. I had pigeons I locked up. I caught them as little ones and had them in a coop and made them pets, sort of. And my brother made me get rid of them because they make such a mess around the buildings. Mm-hmm. But I had bees because pollinating the orchard. Mm-hmm. And you buy bees in a package.
Now, did your father have bees, or did you bring bees to
the house? No. The Lumbergs had bees. Mm-hmm. Smit Lumberg, and he wanted to get away rid of them, so I bought some of his equipment and stuff and the bees, and then I bought some packaged bees, which come in the mail, in a box with screens on it, and inside just a little box with a screen on it with a queen bee in it. Mm-hmm. And there's a hole drilled into that wooden part of the box, and a sugar mixture stuffed in there to plug the hole, and a paper over it, so when you want to introduce the queen to the main bees, you pull that paper off. And when I pulled the paper off, the sugar came, and out come the queen. And I caught the queen in my hand. Didn't want to squeeze her, and I didn't want to lose her either. Mm-hmm. And I just had a short-sleeved shirt on, and all those bees that come out of that box, all over my arm, and there were three or four thick. And I'd been told that a bee sting, 100 bee stings is the same as getting bit by a rattlesnake. It's the same poison, and 100 stings would equal if you let them, the stinger work. Well, I looked at all those bees, and I knew there was more than 100 there, and how was I going to get out of this one? Nobody else around. So I finally worked around and got the cage that the queen came out of and held it up to my hand and got her back in, and then put the plug in and so forth. But then I still had all these bees, and I had to brush them off with a bee brush and get away from it. And, you know, it took me a lot of effort to hold my cool and not just fling my arms, because it's a funny feeling to feel those bees on it. You could feel the weight and to feel the air moving because they were flapping their wings and so forth. And I was very glad when I finally got them back in and got it. Mm-hmm. And I kept bees for quite a while.
You got stung, didn't you?
No.
Because you did it the way you did it.
I didn't hurt anybody. If I'd squeezed a bee or something. Oh. But see, a honeybee, and they sting, and the stinger comes off. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of their life. Mm-hmm. And so it's a last resort for them to sting. But that doesn't mean that they won't do it. Mm-hmm. One time the bee inspector come around, and I had been shearing my sheep, and I just got through shearing the buck sheep, and he'd give me a rough time, and I was all wool grease and sweat and so forth. And I said, well, this is a good time for a break. So I went down with the inspector to check the bees, and he went up and opened up a hive, and I was back about 20 or 30 feet. And just as soon as he opened that hive, they plastered the back of my neck. He counted at least 20 stingers in the back of my neck, just like that. And he scraped them out with a hive tool. And if you do that, you scrape them out, you don't squeeze the poison out of the sack, mm-hmm. the stinger.
And why did they go for you that day?
Because I had all the animal grease on me and sweat. Mm-hmm. Bees don't like either one. Mm-hmm. And when you, especially when you're scared, you give off an odor from your perspiration that bees especially hate. Mm-hmm. And so I was lucky that
what'd you do to tend to yourself if you had
nothing? He got the stingers out before they did much. The only time I ever had trouble it was when my nephew was born, first nephew, and I was down working with the bees, and I went up to had some young chicks come in at the time. I kept my veil on and everything there. I get up to the chicken coop, and I took the veil off, and geez, there's one bee on my hat. And they went right into my mouth and wanted to sting me under the lip. And I brushed it off twice, and the third time he was faster than I was and stung me, and it hit a nerve. And my mother was down with my sister, and she came home and late. I'd been to bed. I had my supper and gone to bed, and I get up, and my lip was swollen out, so it plugged my nose. And she hollered at me to get up and go to school. And I said, I'm not going to school. And, oh, yes, you are. And I said, no, I'm not. She came up and saw my face, then she decided I wasn't. That's the only time a bee sting really bothered me, but it hit a nerve. I knew it when it hit. It hurt more than ordinary. Yeah. Well, next thing that I discuss is the things that different generations lived in as farmers. They have different experiences. My father was quite progressive and had a tractor and so forth, and he converted most of the horse-drawn equipment to be pulled with the tractor and so forth. He especially did that because horses ran away with a reaper and binder and smashed it on him, and he wasn't too happy with horses after that. But I come along, and we had the rubber tire tractors and rubber tire wagons, and we learned to back up four-wheel wagons, where some farmers never could. And my boys had the same experience. Now the next generation has come along, and they've never had any experience because we don't use four-wheel wagons anymore. And they just haven't backed up. And I have hooked up a tractor and belt to embellish to equipment. My boys never have. They've never seen a team of horses on a wagon, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. And it's just such an abrupt change in the way things are done. Mm-hmm. And each generation has done things.
And you're the middle, so you've seen it from both ends.
Yeah. I never saw a treadmill in work. I've seen them in the museum. Mm-hmm. But when I was small, they had a baler come in to bale hay out of one of the farmsteads back years ago. And they pitched the hay out the upstairs down into the baler. Mm-hmm. And they called it a jump press. And the man would fork the hay down into the press and jump on it to pack it in. They'd make a 200-pound bale. Mm-hmm. And then the horses walking around and around, and that turned the gear, that turned the shaft, that did whatever the baler did. I couldn't remember what that was. But they would turn out a fairly heavy bale. And a man couldn't pick it up, but they could roll them, and roll them up stairs, you might say, of steps of bales. And those bales, a fellow lived near the District 5 when I went to school, he would buy a bale from my father, and he would deliver it. He never could pay for it then, for some reason or other. Of course, he probably short of money, as everybody else was at the time. But he'd always bring it up to school, leave it with me to pay my father, and he'd always be 5 cents or a dime short. Tell your father, I think he'll understand. And I said to my father one time about it, and he says, well, I understand. He says, I've upped the weight a few pounds to make up for it. That same guy, my aunt, Helen Lumberg, they had the store, and they, during the war, they closed it. And they had these customers been coming for years and didn't have cars or any way to get to Greenwich. So this gentleman, she used to take him to Greenwich to do his shopping. They're going up the road one day, and he leans over and says, do you have insurance on the car? And she says, yes. Well, it's a good thing, because if you're having an accident, I would sue you. And that's showing appreciation.
Generations. I mean, what do you think about the things about, like, from your father to your time? What were the things that you would say were the most significant improvements or inventions around farming?
Well, I think it was when they started field choppers, combines instead of threshing machines, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It changed things a lot, because before that, we had two neighbors we worked with filling corn silage. Mm-hmm. And my aunt's and mother's brothers, each aunt farms down next to the river, the McCauleys and the Wrights, and we thrashed together. Mm-hmm. And when we got the combine, and
you could do it
alone. So we've never had that group.
Mm-hmm.
thing. And then those things, every place you went, that's where they had the noon meal. Mm-hmm. And it was always quite a meal. Mm-hmm. And the Mrs. Delury was a great cook, but she had a problem after her third child. She would go off her mind, out of her mind. Mm-hmm. And you were awful careful that you didn't get her excited. And we went down, filled the silo there one day, and it was a hot day, and she made three different kinds of pies, and 10-inch pies cut in quarters. And she wanted each man to have one of each three flavors. Well, it was too hot to eat, and then too much, and so they didn't eat too good. But she was pretty upset, and Don, her son, and I figured we'd better eat it, and then go out and try to work in the silo. When you're overstuffed like that, but we didn't dare mm-hmm. not do it. Mm-hmm. But we had some great meals and those mm-hmm. kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that exchange in work so much now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's a gain and a loss, right?
Yeah.
You gain the technology, yeah. but you don't have the social support. Yeah. When you were talking earlier about the apples, like you said, there were all these little orchards. You want to just name those people? I mean, when I think of orchards now, you're it, right?
Yeah.
The Gordons are the only orchard
in Easton. Yeah. Well, every farm had it. The Henderson Farm, which is where the Lambs are now, Sisson's had it. But they weren't selling mm-hmm. apples. The ones who were selling were the Nulties down on the River Road, Havard Pettis up on Route 40, Ed Lumberg, mm-hmm. McGraw's. I don't know, I can't think of the rest of them right now. But
yeah, that's what, I mean, you had a number in your head. You said, I think you said like 14.
I think so,
that's
yeah.
Something.
Oh,
that was like
Briggs's and an orchard, uh-huh. Charlie McCart.
Uh-huh. So that was a, see, I was curious because it was a much more common crop than I thought. So most people... I was thinking, you know, the products, what were the common products? So apples was really one of the things that people...
Originally, most farms had a few apple trees for their own use. Uh-huh. And we never sold apples local because everybody had their own apples, it seemed like. And that's changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it may change more because they're getting so... many complications and regulations that mm-hmm. are difficult. People are so afraid of chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thing is, if you eat a product with a chemical on it, all you have to deal with is what you ate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you eat it, anything that's got an organism on it or a virus, and that hits your system, it expands, they multiply. And you're dealing with a lot instead of that little. So people are worried about chemicals. When I've dealt with chemicals since I was 12 or 13 years old,
mm-hmm.
Lead arsenic, nicotine sulfate, lime sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And lime sulfur is the worst one. And that's one that they claim organic growers can use because it's supposed to be natural. But lime and sulfur never come together. Man put them together in a boil and made the lime sulfur. But that would burn so that we had to wear hoods over us. Would try to see out through a plexiglass. It's all plastered with spray. And if you didn't, it would burn like worse than any sunburn. And my father had an old sprayer with a gasoline motor on it. And like the early motors, it didn't start good. And a good many times, by the time you got it started, the wind would be blowing and you couldn't spray anyway. So he changed it over to power takeoff. And that was one of the first power takeoff machines. And he bought the power takeoff shaft. Another shaft, you could put them together in any of four positions.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't work good that way. We didn't find out for a number of years that we put it together one day and you could turn short and it wouldn't hammer. And the next time you put it together, it would hammer. Well, if you didn't have the yolks lined up the same,
mm-hmm.
it would cause that vibration. One day I was over to the truck shop getting my truck fixed. In fact, I was leaving it. And curious me, the mechanic was looking like he was upset, and he had a truck just pulled in from testing it, and it hadn't worked out right. It was a tractor-trailer. And it'd get going down the road, and it'd vibrate like blazes. And I looked at it, and I see the universals weren't lined up. And I said to him, I said, "They're not lined up." He said, "That's the way the truck come in. And it's always been that way." But I said, well, how come it just started a while ago of bothering? I said, "Probably shook apart, worn enough." Well, his boss come along, and he told him what I suggested, that he line that up. And the boss says, "We've tried everything else. What the devil we got to lose? Do it." So the next day I went back to pick up my truck, and the mechanic wasn't there. And I asked the other mechanic. He says, "Well, he got kind of upset because when he took your suggestion and took the truck out and tried it, it worked." He says, "It's a hell of a note when you have to have a farmer tell you how to fix it." But there was so much to learn about that kind of equipment and changes. And you learned the hard way, is what it was. And my father had started doing custom work, filling silos, when this first tractor was an 816 International. And today the environmental people would have a fit with a tractor like that because there was no crankcase on it. The underside of the motor was wide open. Uh-huh. It had a tank for oil, mm-hmm. and it pumped the oil down through and through the bearings and then out on the ground. Oh. Yeah. That didn't last long. In the third year, the crankshaft broke, and my father had to buy another one. But there wasn't many mechanics in the early days of the equipment that understood it. But we were lucky to have a man live down in Barker's Grove that he'd worked for a dentist, and they called him Doc Elding. And he was quite clever with fitting false teeth, even though he wasn't a dentist. He'd worked in the dentist office, and that was his job. And he moved up into Easton for some reason, and he got in trouble because people were bringing them their false teeth in, and he would refit them for them and make them happy, but he wasn't approved to be doing it. Yeah. But he was quite talented with fixing automobiles or anything. And
he was just a clever guy.
Yeah. And he also had a tow truck. And when I was small, in 1928, my mother's coming up the road right in front of where Lambs live now, the old Henderson place. So a patch of ice and slid over and tipped over against a tree. And I hit the shifting lever with my nose, and I had a bloody nose, and the truck laid over. And Tone Henderson was up on the roof of his house doing something, and he saw it happening.
The whole accident happened.
Yeah, he came down the ladder, and I don't know how fast he could do it, and he jumped up in the car and opened the door and reached down, picked me up, and set me out. But then he could get my mother out of the car.
You were right in the ditch.
Yeah, right, completely right. On its side.
Yeah.
And the only thing, the corner of the roof.
Just the two of you?
Just the two of us. And it marked a little bit on the corner of the roof, otherwise than that, the car wasn't hurt. Mm-hmm. But Doc Elding came down with his tow truck and tipped it back over. And
could you get your mom out before it got tipped up?
Yeah, they got her out somehow. I don't know. I think he had to get help because she was a fair-sized lady and it was up.
She had to climb out.
Yeah. And she was pretty shook up. And I never rode well on slippery roads after that, unless I was driving. I learned to drive on slippery conditions because we raised our chickens in the orchard, the young chickens, and they ranged out under the apple trees. And they thought that was a good process, but it wasn't because it over-fertilized the ground. And anyway, chicken manure all over. And I was up, drove a 28 International, which we still got, up to haul chicken feed up. And one of my first times when it had been raining, I came down, and a two-speed rear-end differential. I put it in the lowest gear, figured that was the safest thing to do, you know. Well, it wasn't. Because I started down the hill, truck slid, the wheels wouldn't go, and of course the hind end would skid around, and I learned how to drive on slippery going. Mm-hmm. It's slipperier than any ice you ever saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. did you sell eggs, or did you just use the eggs yourself?
No, we sold eggs. Back in those days, you'd go up to Skiff's store in Greenwich and take some eggs, and they'd credit your towards your grocery bill, and that was it. And then during the war, before the war, we had a peddling route in Troy. My mother had lots of relatives down there to help us get started, and we delivered eggs there for several years. And then we got hooked up with Friar's Hatchery for hatching eggs. And that worked out pretty good. You had a little premium for hatching eggs. You had to have the chickens inspected, checked for health and so forth, a little extra work. We were producing crossbreed between Plymouth Rock and hens and Rhode Island roosters. And the Plymouth Rocks developed some kind of a disease they weren't quite sure of. And the guy that come around to inspect the chickens provided the Plymouth Rocks that he sold to Fran and Fryer that he sold to us and so forth. And he was telling me how he was having a lot of trouble with them. And I said something to Henry about it. I said, can we go for another breed? No, he says, either that or nothing. Well, the mortality was so high that we had to quit on the Plymouth Rock. So that was the end of the chicken business. That was my main interest to coming back on the farm. I like chickens better than I do cows. They're simpler-brained animals. And I don't know whether you realize, you can take a chicken, stick their head under one wing, and rock them back and forth, and then lay them down on that wing, and they'll have to sleep there for an hour or two. Or you can lay them down and take a stick and scratch a line in the dirt, and they're hypnotized for a while. It might be quite a while, and that's something disturbs them. They're a lot easier to handle than cows. And they don't kick.
Yeah. So after the Plymouth Rock thing, you didn't continue with the chicken business?
No, that
was the end of it?
Yeah.
Now, when we were gathered here, somebody said one day, who could talk about the chickens in Easton? Like, were there more than the Friars involved with the chickens in Easton, like raising chickens? Was there a lot of...
Oh, yeah. Okay. There's quite a few people who worked for Friar. Now, one of them is Phyllis Pearson.
Oh,
And B. Steen worked at Friar's. And so forth. And they had quite a business going. And
did Mary Alice work for Friar's too?
Her father did, I believe.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
But that was a real good, strong business for a number of years. And then they used to have, this is before the war, of course, Japanese guys come in to sex the chickens and separate the roosters from the pullets. And some people bought the roosters to raise for meat, and the people wanted just for eggs to buy the pullets. And that was going. That came about in early. But you know, when they first started hatching chickens, and synthetic hatcheries, I guess you say, you know, in an incubator, some people thought it was going to be the end of the chicken business. The chickens wouldn't be right, and this wouldn't be right, and so forth. But it really made the chicken business go, as the hatching. Yeah.
When you talked about the war a lot, like in your experience, what was the biggest event in history that, like, made an impression on you? Like, in the history of your time, like, what was the biggest event?
Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Yeah, I can remember that day very plainly because it was on a Sunday, and we usually had cousins and stuff up from Troy on a Sunday, and we'd sometimes make ice cream and so forth and so on. And the news come apart about the Japanese attack, and somebody tipped one of my mother's teacups over, and it said, "Made in Japan." And they started throwing those things around. And, you know, I think they broke the handle off of one. They were the strongest little China things you could ever expect. But
they were throwing them and they didn't even break.
No, yeah. they were trying to break them.
They couldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. But from then on, of course, everything was going for the war. The other thing is I had sheep, and I shore the sheep in the spring, and the government froze the wool. You couldn't sell it till they told you to. You could. So I stacked the wool in an old chicken coop, and when August, they said, okay, now you take them over, this guy over in Cambridge. I went down to load the truck, and it was full of bumblebees.
Oh, my God.
And
the bees were in the fleece?
It made nests right in the fleece. Mm-hmm. And we had a closed truck body, and it's an old meat body, so it shut up real tight. I put on my bee veil and stuff and threw the fleeces in the truck and shut it up. And the next morning, I went to deliver it. I was hoping by then the deep bees would be dormant, maybe. I don't know what I was hoping for. Got over there and backed the truck up, and the guy says, put it over there. He went someplace else, and I heaved them out just as fast as I could. Of course, they were couldn't see in the dark truck body too good. And I got them all stacked up where I was supposed to before the guy come back. And boy, says, where'd all these bees come from? And I said, I don't know. I got my paperwork done and got out of there.
Yeah. But, they got a little extra.
Yeah, I don't know what he did with it, but I was rid of it anyway.
Now, what was your breed of sheep that you raised?
Hampshire's. And Liddell's helped me get started with it. And most of my sheep come from every farmhand sheep in those days. Mm-hmm. And if they had a ewe that couldn't take care of the lamb, or she died, or the hand out her trouble or something, they didn't want to feed it on a bottle, they'd bring it down to me. And I have several bottle lambs to take care of. Mm-hmm. And the lambs would go to Easter Market, the males and the females I kept them for breeding stock. So I get up to around 40 or 50 sheep, mm-hmm. which isn't much. Some of them had 400 or 500 around at that time.
Wow.
And over in Shushan area, there was a factory there at one time that handled a special wool. And the sheep, they imported a bunch of sheep from Europe, I guess, to supply that market. And there was quite an industry there for a short period of time.
Wow. Now, what would your mother make for, put together a meal? Like, what would it be? Everything from the farm?
Mostly.
Would you raise just about everything that was on your table?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. We grew potatoes, and my father kept a big garden. We had squash and stuff that he grew and sold too. Uh-huh. And then we'd butcher pigs and cows. And my mother would can meat and so forth.
Would you have your own
chickens? Oh, and own chickens, yeah.
Yeah.
The best part about chickens is you could slaughter them in easy time and anytime, such a big operation as slaughtering a cow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were the kids in the garden, or was that an adult? Did you guys as kids have to work in the garden?
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. It was kind of hard to get us there, I guess. My father enjoyed garden work, I guess, and he did the most of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a strawberry patch and cherry patch and all that kind of stuff. And like parsnips and stuff on the garden, and in the spring of the year, cowslips. If you got them before they blossomed, they weren't too bad.
What'd you do? Like boil them? Or?
Yeah, like spinach.
Like spinach?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a real treat because that was one of the first fresh green things you could get in the spring.
The first thing that you see, right?
And otherwise than that, and just what was in season.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the same way in the grocery stores, they didn't have vegetables in wintertime.
Yeah.
There's one store down in Scaticook that used to come in National Biscuit Company and boxes about that square with a window in front. I guess the window stayed. They had these cardboard boxes go back of these little glass doors, and you'd open the door and take out what cookies you wanted, real sanitary type of thing. This one grocer down there will find some broken cookies in the bottom of the box. So he put them in another box and put a special price on them. The answer demand for me had to break up cookies to supply the demand. And the druggist down there, somebody went in to get something, a regular common thing, and he didn't have any. He said, "What are you going to get in there?" He said, "Oh, I quit stocking it." I said, "I can't keep it on the shelf. It goes out so fast." Real merchandising.
But would you go to Scaticoke before you go to Greenwich if you needed, like if you were looking for your dry goods and things like that?
Yeah, there was a dry goods store down there and so forth, and we'd go down there to get feed ground at Hoosick Valley. Mm-hmm. My father was invested in that, mm-hmm. and so went there and so forth.
When you would go visit Troy, like to your mom's relatives, would you go on the train or would you drive?
Dover, yeah. Mm-hmm. I rode in the 28 International for delivering apples down there when I was 5 weeks old.
Down in Troy.
Yeah. And in the wintertime, that could be quite a trip. Because in those days...
You were 5 weeks old, Jim?
Yeah. My mother went along, too. The city of Troy didn't plow streets in early days.
They still don't.
And the bus company used to, they spread out sand, and it's plugged up the sewers, and the city, Troy, sued them for